C7. Number 7B.
Yeah. Again, you can see in the textbook the real meaning of the whole chapter, Toman and Eucharist, is all somehow lined up to the fact that we should overcome suffering through our at-one-ment or atonement with God to the point of being at-one-ment, and that therefore in a process of atoning we really have a sense of suffering, whereas actually from the point of view of oneness there is no suffering. On the level of divine science we do not have any suffering, nor do we need to handle any suffering. Now here again, let me give you two examples in the text of this chapter which bring out those two aspects. Both statements are in the same chapter. So I start first with the textbook matrix sense, namely where she says, waking to Christ's demand. Can you hear that this is now not oneness, that it is waking to? It's still a sense of being separate from the Christ, but waking to Christ's demand, mortals experience suffering. Something people don't like to read. They would love if that sentence would not be in the textbook, that they say, well, if I wake to Christ's demands, then everything should be just a rosy pathway. And Mrs. Eddy says, you experience suffering. Because the Christ puts forth demands on the human, and the human usually doesn't like to yield. So it gives a crisis, it gives a sense of suffering. So can you see at one point in this chapter, Mrs. Eddy would say, waking to Christ's demands, mortals experience suffering. Then I take another one that belongs now into our oneness matrix, where she says, the eternal Christ, his spiritual selfhood, Jesus' spiritual selfhood, never suffered. Never suffered. Do you see that is oneness, where suffering is excluded, sin is excluded through oneness, everything evil is excluded at the point of oneness where only the God-like is exemplified. Now I can see very easily that an intelligent reader of the textbook, he just cannot fathom the meaning of this textbook. Because an intelligent reader, and under intelligent I mean a reader who is used to think logically now again in the classical logic, not in the modern logic, because there are very few who are trained in the modern logic, but in the classical logic he says, now what is true? Either Christ brings suffering or Christ never suffers. Now what is true? There are two statements of absolute opposite interpretation, of opposite presentation. Which one is true? And now, naturally, we can see the moment we can put each statement in its true dimension, on its right level, and see that every level has its own logic, must have its own logic, because it has a different meaning, then these two statements can easily be reconciled. So that on the mortal level, waking to Christ, the Christ brings suffering. On the level of oneness, the Christ does not know anything about suffering, is free from suffering. And so these examples just could expanded and expanded. This chapter is full of it, and it shows really that what the oneness here shows is that the unity with God, which is sinlessness, because oneness with God is the most deadly enemy for sin, that oneness with God, only the God-like is exemplified. There is no exemplification anymore of the God-unlike. All right, then let's try to put this into a law, which we afterwards can elaborate. We could see, let us take that law and if possible write it on one line, perhaps even on one line, so that at the end on the right side you still have enough room to put in some terms, some ideas then when we elaborate it further. We could say, through man's oneness with God, the God-like is exemplified. The God-like is exemplified. Again, a very simple, clear statement or law. Again, I nearly want to excuse myself that this law is so simple. But you know, they say in natural science, in the exact science, they say the simpler a law looks like, therefore is formulated, the bigger its impact. It isn't the voluminous symbols of a law that make it very big and important. Just think of Einstein's wonderful, small, simple law, E=mc². It's so simple, there's only three symbols in it, and the impact of it is terrific. It has changed the whole universe, it has changed everything in physics, it has changed the whole technology in the world. Everything has been changed by this simple law E=mc². And they even say, the philosophers in physics even say a formula must look like a poetry. Must be so warm and so beautiful. And it's a beautiful law. That E=mc², when you look at it, it's so balanced, it's so beautiful, it's so simple, so majestic, nothing cumbersome, nothing blown up. And so I hope that now from this moment on I'm no more going to excuse myself that these laws look very simple. They are deep. It's only a matter, can we understand it? Can we interpret rightly what E=mc² means, you know? The implications are terrific. You can imply from it that there is no more a straight line in the universe. That's one of the implications. See, you for a first sight, you wouldn't see that this is an implication, that there is no straight line in the universe anymore, that such a thing as a straight line does not exist. It implies that little formula, that the whole Euclidean geometry is outdated, that it's no more valid 100%, things like that, you know. When one can read a law, the law is terrific in its implication. So it is again a matter of us, what we put into it without deviating from the law naturally. So we are not going to put any old inspiration into a law and deviate to the right and left from the law, but to see what does it really mean. So we could sit down and just go through it, you see, and you could now, as a first step, really elaborate it just by substituting the seventh synonymous term for the term God, you see. So it would mean, through man's oneness with mind, instead of with God, through man's oneness with mind, the mind-like is exemplified. the mind like is exemplified. And so you can go right through with those ditto signs and see that through man's oneness with spirit, the spirit-like is exemplified. Through man's oneness with soul, the soul-like is exemplified. And right through principle, life, truth, love. Then you have a first elaboration of a simply stated law. Do you see why it is an elaboration? Because the one term God is substituted by seven terms. It's an elaboration. Then again, we could say now, how does mind and spirit and soul, principle, life, truth and love exemplify itself? How do they have a kind of exemplification through the power of the messianic work? What is it that is brought out? Therefore, it must be brought out somehow, a power sense in it. You see, or it isn't atonement and Eucharist. Again, we just can't take, actually, for this seventh synonymous term, any one of the ideas that we have on our list. They should have somehow the power sense, the exemplifying sense, which is always power, huh? Something at work in order to exemplify it. So let's see what we could put there. If we have mind, through man's oneness with mind, what kind of a mind-like exemplification do we get? It would have to be really a mind power sense. It is exemplified, for instance, by doing the will of God. Huh? By doing, by acting. That's an exemplification of mind as a power sense. So you can, for instance, put there, by doing the will of God, or by acting courageously, wouldn't you feel that that would be an exemplifying sense, by acting courageously? When it comes to spirit, what could we see there in spirit? What is an active power sense of spirit? It certainly wouldn't be just substance, huh? So substance is not a power sense in it, but you could see that oneness with spirit, the spirit-like exemplifies itself as the unfoldment of spirit. Huh? Unfoldment is an active power sense to unfold spiritually. That would be exemplifying. To unfold spiritually. What could we put in soul? If we would see how is soul exemplified as a soul-like, again we could see, well, it's certainly not sinlessness or joy. Huh? Must be a power sense in it, something that has a drive in it, and so we would see that it exemplifies itself as, for instance, perseverance in on the way from sense to soul. Perseverance. That's a strong power sense, huh? Now, can you see at this point how you have to know now your synonymous terms, huh? Without knowing now the ideas of the synonymous term, we are lost, we are at sea. Or, if you take principle, you would feel now our oneness with principle, the principle-like exemplifies itself. What is an exemplifying power of principle? You would have the power of demonstration. Huh? Principle demonstrates spiritual power, that's the exemplification of the principle-like. Yeah? Demonstrating the spiritual power. If you have life... Sorry, am I going too fast? If I take life and I see that through my unity with life, what happens in me as an exemplification?
Huh?
See, you must have now a power sense in it, that the Christ power that overcomes every human at every point. What can it do to my life when I'm empowered by life, when I'm driven by life? Huh? I feel the drive of life. Huh? I feel the pursuing of the way of life. I'm going the way of life. Huh? Do you feel something? So, again, the power sense in it, an active sense in it. So you could have that pursuing the way of life, going the way of life, the drive of life. Hmm? Yeah? That's what I exemplify then. Huh? I don't exemplify then just isness, because that would not be a Christ power sense in it. Huh? Yeah? Do you get the sense what we gain when we culture our synonymous term as we did it last week, and culture that for a few years, so that those synonymous terms become so finely rarefied and polished that we can detect in these ideas of life all the shades and hues, not so much of life, but of the four-dimensional orders. Huh? See, what we put into it is now the category of the Word as the Christ. Huh? Yeah. Do you know what I meant? We choose out of the whole list of ideas those ideas that give us not only a tone of the synonymous term, but also a tone of that other category of the Word as the Christ. Hmm? Or we take truth. And so we have a sense that if I'm one with truth, then the truth-like is being exemplified. How have I a power sense of exemplifying truth? I have perhaps that power sense by affirming the status of manhood, huh? By acclaiming and affirming the true stature of manhood. That would be perhaps truth here. Claiming and affirming the stature of manhood. Can you see the beauty? In prayer, we also had a sense of oneness. Namely, the oneness where I accept that I'm one, that man is one with God, that I'm one with God, with truth. I'm one with truth. I claim that. I see I'm one with truth. But what on earth is that going to do with me? The moment I ask, what is that oneness going to do with me? How does it exemplify itself? Then I have a dominant Eucharist. Then I have a sense of the Word as the Christ and says, that oneness with truth is going to do something with me. It activates, the Christ activates within me that I'm jolly well going to affirm the whole stature of manhood within me. And don't let it go. Or let's go to the last one, to love, and see what happens there. And we can see that, say, through man's oneness with love, that's prayer. Now, the second chapter says, the love-like is exemplified in me. What is now the driving sense of love? The driving sense of love, I would say here, I'm going to fulfill the plan of love. I'm acting, I'm fulfilling love's plan. Perhaps you can take in that is a fulfilling the plan of love in me. Yeah? Now, you see, if you would now compare these specified ideas of the synonymous term with those that we had in prayer, and you would see they are not the same. They are not the same ideas. They are different ideas. And to contemplate these differences is actually that which makes the difference between prayer and Adoration and Eucharist, between the attitude of oneness in prayer and the attitude of oneness in Adoration and Eucharist. And because they are different, can you see what I tried to bring out, that we have to get rid of a simplistic sense of oneness and have a more differentiated sense of oneness. So that only in this way we really free ourselves from a mystical sense of oneness, which is amorphous, and get into a structured sense of oneness, which is science. Now, the qualities I have taken here when going through the seven are actually those that are brought out mainly in the textbook, when we look at the textbook-wise, at the textbook matrix, the structure of it. These are the qualities of mind in Atonement and Eucharist, of spirit and soul and principle, life, truth and love. And again, you see, you can see what an enormous value we would actually gain if we would have the structure of the textbook as a living structure within our consciousness. That is, if really those seven subjects of each chapter would be absolutely present in our consciousness, just as it's present in our consciousness, the numeration table in arithmetic, it's present. We don't have to look it up every time and say, now how is it? Now if I have the five and I take the five, what is 5 times 1, 5 times 2, 5 times 3, 5 times 5? It's present in one's consciousness. It's no more in a numeration table. It's now in consciousness. And in that same way, we really should have the whole textbook present in their structure. So that if we refer back to the chapter on prayer, we just should somehow see what are the seven forms of prayer. If we look back into the Atonement and Eucharist, something just should stand out in our consciousness and say, oh yes, these are the seven subjects in Atonement and Eucharist. They shouldn't be something far-fetched. They shouldn't be something to be memorized. They shouldn't be something one has to look up every time. They should be right there because they are natural to the system. Yeah. If I say natural to the system, what do I actually mean? It means that we should be able to calculate those subjects ourselves. If we know the seven, and actually we should be able to know the seven after culturing them for a few years, and actually it should not be so difficult to have a sense of the 4x4, after all, that's only 16. And even these can be calculated always from the 4. It's very easy. So that by combining these two categories, the categories of the 4x4 with the 7x7, should be a very easy thing. It's nothing very difficult. In any other subject which we learn at the university, we have to learn much more as fundamental terminology, as fundamental elements, much more. This is actually very simple compared with any other scientific subject that is taught at the university. And if we would have that, you can see that then the textbook would fulfill its purpose, its destiny. It would really be a textbook and no more a reading book, no more a catechism, no more a reference book. It's awful to have a textbook as a reference book. But isn't the reference book always textbook taken always as a reference book? You discuss something with somebody, and the next thing you know is Mrs. Eddy says on page 273, line so and so, this and this, and then a quote. This is a reference book. This is not the... They don't treat the textbook as a textbook anymore, or has never been seen as a textbook. But we have to do that step, to make that step. Yes? All right. So, here I wanted to give one or the other example how really these subjects flow into each other, and how actually the oneness matrix is not separate from the textbook matrix, that they flow into each other. The moment we take the oneness matrix and ask for an elaboration of it, an elaboration means what? You go to the level of absolute Christian science, because absolute Christian science says, I have a synonymous term, and the synonymous term expresses itself through its ideas. Do you see how in this way the oneness matrix blends then with the textbook matrix? Okay, we make a break here.